and welcome to the Blues Guitar Show podcast with me, Ben Martin, from thebluesguitarshow.com. This week, I've got a really special interview lined up for you. I am talking to David Hamburker, who is an artist, a teacher, an award-winning author, composer, producer, and everything in between. He's a virtuoso fingerstyle guitar player and writer of the award-winning Beginning Blues Guitar book. I hope you really, really enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thank you very much to David for giving over some of his time. Enjoy, everybody. Okay, great stuff. Well, I'm on with David. Thank you very much for joining us, man. How you doing?
Doing well, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, fantastic. So are you in Texas? Is that right?
I am. I'm in Austin. I'm not from here, but I've been here for a good long time now.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Massachusetts, right outside of Boston, where it's sort of a cottage industry to make fun of people from England because of the war.
Of course.
Sorry about that.
I won't hold it against you.
Well, then I moved to New York when I got out of school. I was there for about 14 years. I moved here in 2000 and I've been here ever since.
Fantastic. Cool, man. So I would describe you as a kind of, I mean, you're an artist, you're a teacher, you're an author, composer, producer. How would you kind of describe yourself if you had to give yourself a small one sentence kind of bio right now?
Yeah, I would call myself a fingerstyle guitar player who writes his own songs and likes to improvise.
Excellent.
Everything else is kind of part of the hustle or around that or through it. Or part of it, or, you know, but if I had to pick one thing to sail off into the sunset as, that's kind of the thing. That's what I teach. Not really the songwriting part, but, you know, my entire sort of teaching world at this point is around fingerstyle guitar. And as a performer, that's really, I mean, I've done a lot of different things, but my last two records have been acoustic records. I just finished recording an all instrumental solo guitar record. And everything that I teach online at the moment is basically built around teaching people how to play better fingerstyle blues.
Fantastic. That's cool. I mean, that's kind of how I think that's how I came about you. I'm not sure. It might have been through the acoustic guitar magazine stuff, because I used to read that. But I think it's probably more likely through the YouTube stuff, because I'm always pointing people in the direction of your YouTube channel. I think your YouTube channel is fantastic. And I think a lot of the YouTube stuff out there is either a little bit hard to follow, or it kind of, you know, they teach you one part of something and they keep the rest all behind a paywall. But I mean, you are really generous with what you give away on YouTube. How did that stuff start for you?
Well, you know, I have been teaching almost as long as I've been playing. And so there was this evolution, but basically when I was living in New York, I started teaching at a summer workshop. And through that, I wrote a book really early on, probably didn't have any business doing it, but I wrote an electric blues guitar book called Beginning Blues Guitar. Mm-hmm. And from that, that led to writing for magazines. So I wrote for Guitar Player and Acoustic Guitar pretty early on. And so then when things started rolling into video, I was one of the early people to make videos for True Fire. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of stuff for them. And then as the world started to turn towards, you know, everybody doing everything themselves, I started Fretboard Confidential maybe 6 years ago, and it was a little sporadic at first. And then, good friend of my brother-in-law was a little bit at loose ends and started helping me with the production part of it. And his main other job was working for a very successful yoga channel. And he was just like, listen, man, if you want this to work, you should put something out every week. Come up with some titles. We'll shoot like six next week. We'll shoot six in a few weeks. You'll just have stuff in the can. And so that was when I started taking the YouTube channel more seriously. And that was maybe 6 years ago. And I started sending out an email every week announcing the new YouTube. And after a little while, I realized there was probably more I could do with that than just tell people to go watch my YouTube lesson. And when I played solo gigs, I always really enjoyed talking in between the songs, probably as much as doing the songs themselves. And so I started writing the newsletter as if I was just, you know, at a good show where everything was kind of working. And I would just tell these kind of Shaggy Dog stories and eventually roll into the point, which was, oh, and by the way, there's a lesson about blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And as that was happening, I also started looking at the YouTube lessons more like, well, the first ones were like, what do I think I should do? And so it was a lot of copycat. It was like, well, people talk about this, so I should talk about that too. And then I just started making lessons about what I was working on or what I thought was interesting. And a lot of that was trying to kind of take the more traditional blues stuff and just see what else you could do with it. Because I don't really know that pre-war stuff inside out. I always tell people, like, please, for the love of God, just go to Homespun Tapes or go to Tom Feldman's mm-hmm. site, or go to one of these people that's just like, got it, you know? And so I can't sit there and show you like, well, you know, here's exactly how Gary Davis played, blah, blah, blah. I play fingerstyle guitar and I like to do stuff with it. And I learned how to do it from listening to traditional music. But mostly what I started talking about was, well, if you're playing alternating thumb picking in C and you want to play something a little different, here are a few different things you could try and do. Or if you're playing blues in E, here's how you can use those chord voicings that Freddie Green liked to play with Count Basie and use those to walk up the neck playing by yourself. And so as I started to do that, I started to enjoy it more and the response got better. And so it was just one of those things of just slowly starting to tack in the direction of the things that people were reacting positively to, which mm-hmm. worked simply because I was the one who started the ball rolling with, I think this is interesting to me. Let's find out if anybody else wants to know about it. So by the time I got to doing my membership, the Fingerstyle 5, which I guess was fall of 2019, and I went through some iterations to get to that. But then by that point, I was like, okay, this is what I like to talk about. This is what I want to teach. This is what I think is missing. And so I really went for a very specific thing that I didn't think necessarily anybody else in our world was particularly talking about.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really interesting. How did you kind of come by that style of guitar playing? I mean, from your kind of earliest start of guitar playing, how did you come to that niche?
Yeah. Well, I started playing guitar when I was 12, and I had heard a lot of folk music already at that point. I'd heard commercial folk music because my parents had like Kingston Trio records and that kind of stuff. And when I was growing up, there was a TV show on public TV in Boston with this musician named Tony Salatin who played the banjo. The idea that a guy who played the banjo could be on TV now seems like not really network TV, but there were only, you know, a few stations and one of them was public television. So I saw him play. And then I went to this summer camp where there was a lot of old, I didn't know it was called old timey music at that point, but there were like people who played banjo and people who played guitar. So I learned a little bit of that and I came home and I was like, the easiest way to start taking lessons, my parents borrowed a guitar from a neighbor and the local rec center had a guitar teacher and she happened to be a bluegrass and folk musician. I've told the story a million times, but her name was Lucille Magliazzi and her brothers did a really popular public radio show called Car Talk for like 30 years. And their theme music was a piece of music by David Grisman. So they were obviously into bluegrass, the whole family. But so I went and took these lessons. And so when I was 12, I learned like how to pattern pick and I learned how to play a fiddle tune with a flat pick. I learned how to play bass runs. I learned all that stuff. Like the first year I learned to play guitar while I was listening to like Revolver and trying to figure out like how to play Day Tripper and like all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And listening to Dylan. And so I also was petrified of singing. And I figured out early on that if I finger picked, I could kind of play the melody on top and keep the, it would sound like I was singing kind of like I would have the melody of the song and not just a picking pattern. And so that was kind of a cool thing to figure out. And then I guess, I started getting guitar records at the public library. So I heard pretty early on, like in high school, I heard Ry Cooder. Mm-hmm. I heard Roy Bookbinder. I would go see guitar players. There was a guitar player named Preston Reed, who was kind of a big deal in the sort of instrumental guitar. He was like a post, like the generation after Leo Kottke. Like, I didn't necessarily have a Leo Kottke record, but a friend of mine had this Preston Reed record. He lived in Connecticut. He would come up and play in like coffee houses in Boston. Mm-hmm. And then there was a folk radio station. I mean, a lot of this, as I'm saying this, I never really put all this together, but like public television, public radio, like public library, like there was a lot out there that you could sort of soak up as a kid who didn't have a lot of resources and a lot of records. You know, there were all these college radio stations around Boston. One of them, Emerson College Radio, they had like a huge folk program on every day. There was a club in Cambridge called Passim that had been around since the 60s. Everybody played there in the 60s. It was still open. It's still open now. And, you know, it wasn't a bar, so you could go when you were underage. Mm-hmm. And so I went and probably heard stuff. Things would come into town. My parents liked music. My dad played the piano. So, you know, I would see music for free in town, like, you know, a bluegrass band would come or a Dixieland band would come or, you know, some other kind of thing would come. They'd play, like there was a summer series on the town square. So there was a lot of different stuff to hear. So I heard those kinds of music and way more than I heard like what was hot at the time. Like, you know, later I met guitar players my age who had grown up on nothing but like Hendrix and Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
I felt like such a freak because I'd never learned any of that, you know? And when I finally heard Led Zeppelin, I was like, oh, it's blues. Right. But it's just really loud. I mean, I heard Cream, like, you know, I had a good friend in high, my best friend growing up also played guitar. We met when I was 13. And so we would listen to things, we would turn each other on to things like, you know, we'd hear Cream or we'd hear, you know, he had the first BB King record I ever heard. A good friend of his was a year older, went to Harvard, worked at the radio station. And so he, quote unquote, liberated their copy of BB King Live at the Regal. So when we heard BB King, we were like, oh, that's what those guys are trying to do, you know? Yeah. So that was huge. And then, oh, John Hurt, they had a John Hurt record at the library. So I heard that. That was probably the first like, you know, real pre-war blues that I heard. But it
is
was
that basically a big influence for you, John Hurt?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, because for a couple of reasons, one is it's the only guy from that world that I could get my hands on. Like I couldn't find Charlie Patton. I couldn't find Leighton and Hopkins. I couldn't even find Gary Davis. I mean, I had like two Gary Davis cuts on a Vanguard anthology that they had recorded live at the Newport Folk Festival. So I heard like Death Don't Have No Mercy and like one other tune. But honestly, like John Hurt was, and I've heard this from other friends too. Like I have a friend here in town, Peter Kane, who's a real scholar of that stuff. And especially John Hurt. John Hurt is so much more accessible to a lot of people like me. It's because first of all, he doesn't like scream and you can, you know, he's singing is very conversational. You can understand what the words are. I could, you know, as like a little white New England guy, you know, I knew what he was, I could understand what was happening. The guitar playing was, you could hear what he was doing. Like when I first heard some of these Delta guys, I was like, what? You know, but John Hurt, it's like, oh, he's finger picking a C chord. Now it is trickier than it sounds. You know, John Hurt, there's plenty of intricacy there. I'm not saying it's not as important or complicated as anything else, but it's accessible. It was to me.
But I think there's also like the quality of a lot of John Hurt stuff. If you compare it to some of the like Charlie Pattons, it becomes more accessible because as you can say, you can hear what's going on much clearer and you can kind of try and work it out. I mean, if, you know, if I try and work out a Charlie Patton song from an original recording, that would take a long time.
Yeah. And also like some, it just depends who an artist recorded for, you know, like some of those recordings, there's so much to listen through just to get to the music. There's so much surface noise and all of this stuff. Whereas the John Hurt, you know, John Hurt lived long enough to make records in the 60s. So it was easier to listen to. If you got those records he made on Vanguard, which is all I had, I didn't have the original OK recordings until much later, but I had Mississippi John Hurt. What was the record called? Either Mississippi John Hurt Today or something. It was one of the ones he made for Vanguard and it was brand new. You know, it had been made in the 60s in a modern studio. And it was just really much easier to listen. Same reason all the revivalist guys like Dave Van Ronk and even, you know, John Hammond, anybody who recorded like in the 60s was just, they had, because they had learned it, this is my theory is that in learning that music, they sort of smoothed it out a little bit and made it a little more regular, but they also recorded in cleaner, more modern circumstances. So between those two things, it was way easier to learn from the folk revival people than it was from the original artists, combined with the fact that I couldn't find most of the records until I was already a lot further along.
That makes sense. And also, I mean, a lot of those 60s recordings onwards are also in tune, which, you know, which really helps when you're sitting with a guitar and trying to figure it out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I felt really apologetic for a long time that I learned more from folk revival guys than from original pre-war guys. And now I'm just like, whatever. I learned from a lot of different people, and a lot of the people I learned from weren't even blues guitar players. So at this point, I don't really care.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hear a lot of that Mississippi John Hurt style in your playing.
I think anybody who plays alternating thumb style, you know, I mean, he was the model. Well, I mean, I also learned from all the usual 60s people, like, and especially later when I was teaching, like, I had to learn Helplessly Hoping, and I tried to learn Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, and Dear Prudence, and Julia, and like all these like set pieces from 60s rock. Mm-hmm. But all of those things, and, you know, Dylan, I mean, so many people learned basically from John Hurt. I mean, he was around in the 60s, and people could learn from him. And it was a very regular, the way he played was more consistent and more regular than some of the other Delta players. So if you played in an alternating thumb style in the 60s, I'm pretty sure a lot of that came from John Hurt. And so I think that we're all kind of inheritors of that. You know, you listen to Merle Travis, it's so much harder. He's playing all over the neck. He's doing all this crazy stuff where he's brushing the strings and he's using his index finger, or Gary Davis. Like, that stuff.
He was the same, right? Two fingers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot, I can't prove this because I'm not one of these, you know, people like the late Steve James who can like cite chapter and verse on where exactly everything comes from. But my own just amateur crackpot theory is that, like, if you learned to finger pick from records made in the 60s, you're getting second or third hand John Hurt.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it makes complete sense. Absolutely. So you released an album back in 2022.
I did.
Beautiful Scar.
Yes.
And as you say, it's kind of the last couple of records, a few records have been acoustic focused. How do you approach writing that stuff? Because it's something that I play a lot of. I play a lot of fingerstyle stuff, and I do shows playing fingerstyle stuff, but I almost never write in that style. How do you kind of approach that?
Really? I'm curious. I mean, so do you write like strumming and then like readapt it, or like what happens for you?
Oh, I don't do a lot of writing, if I'm honest. If I play, it's usually session stuff. It is, as in if I record, and if I'm doing live shows, I'm normally playing covers. I do a lot of improvising and stuff, but I've never I very, very rarely sit down and write something kind of fingerstyle. I'm just interrupting this episode to let you know about the Blues Guitar Show Plus membership. Plus members get access to weekly lessons each Friday, complete with tabs and downloads. For just $5 a month, you'll get instant access to nearly a year's worth of guitar lessons covering finger picking, fretboard theory, soloing, improvising, slide, and much, much more. If you're tired of bouncing around on YouTube trying to pick up bits of information from here and from there, and you find it hard to commit to regular lessons, this is for you. Details of how to join are in the description below. Now back to the episode.
Huh. Well, okay. So I made a decision at a certain point. Are you familiar with Steve James? He just passed away. Mm-hmm. Great American blues songwriter. Yeah. So when I first moved to Austin, I already knew about him, but I got to see him, you know, a bunch because he was my neighbor. Actually, we lived in the same neighborhood for a little while. And I would go see him. He didn't play much in Austin because he was on the road most of the time. He played in Austin once or twice a year. But when I went to see him, I mean, when I got to Austin, I thought, oh, Steve James, he's a blues guy. And then I went to see him play and I was like, oh, he writes his own songs. Oh, he plays like some alternating thumb stuff. He plays some slide. He does this, he does that. It's a really varied show. It's not just like, chunk, 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 chunk. But he does it all on a national and he's always finger picking. Mm. And I thought, because I at that point had played, when I would play a gig or make a record even, it was a mix. I would strum some songs if that was the groove it needed. I would finger pick if that was the kind of thing that it was. And when I saw Steve, I was like, I just kind of made this executive decision. I was like, okay, I'm only going to play fingerstyle from now on. And if it doesn't work without a pick, then that song is out of my repertoire. So there were songs that were like, that I was really proud of that I'd written where I was like, well, I'm just not going to be playing that one, at least not for now.
Oh, wow. And
so I just switched. I just said like, whatever I got to do, I'm going to get it out of these guys. And so I just was like, well, if I'm writing, I'm going to write that way. And the thing that it did is it forced me to slowly evolve, because there's only so many steady bass and alternating thumb things you can do before you go, God, I need to play another feel. I need to play another groove. And so that I started figuring out ways to, even though the thumb was still there in an alternating style, I gradually found myself doing different kinds of syncopations and things on top to kind of disguise the alternating thumb so that it would feel different than just pattern picking. And then the real acceleration came a few years ago when I started listening to Charlie Hunter, who I'd been hearing about for a million years, but I don't know, I stumbled across one particular record on Spotify and just fell in love with it. And when I heard how much syncopation and how much independence he had in the bass while playing these guitar parts on top, really lit a fire under me to try to start experimenting with that. And I still can't, I mean, the guy's been working on that for 30 years. So I'm working on my thing, and that's just sort of that's an influence that I'll suck up as much of as I can get. Mm. But I noticed when I was making this recording last week, I noticed that a couple of not every kind of syncopation under the sun. It doesn't sound like James Jamerson down there or anything, but like there are some grooves I can now do almost as intuitively as I can play an alternating thumb that are definitely neither steady bass nor alternating thumb. And that really pleases me.
That's really cool. So in terms of the stuff you're working on right now, you say it's instrumental. How is that different to writing stuff with vocals? How do you approach it differently?
And I realize I didn't really answer your last question about writing songs with fingerstyle, except to say that the way I write songs that have fingerstyle parts is that's my palette. That's all I, that's all I allow myself, you know? And so when I sit down to come up with, at its best, I write words first, or at least I have to have like a lyric idea first. And then I start shopping for like a setting for it, you know? So it's almost like my brain is divided into like, you know, the lyric guy and the music guy, like the old Broadway composing teams, you know, where they have a assistant. And so like, I try to get at least an idea that I'm excited about for the lyrics, pick up the guitar to get a little of an idea of where it might go musically, but it's mostly driven by the phrasing. But once I have like a words idea, the rhythm of the words is really important to me. And that's how I start to figure out what the feel is going to be, because words are phrasing, and phrasing is the melody, and the melody starts to drive what kind of groove it's going to need and where it might want to go harmonically. But so writing instrumentally means I start with the guitar, and I don't really, mostly I write as a kind of job. Like I come up with music. I came up with a ton of music when I was making True Fire videos, because they would say, well, you're going to shoot this course on X and we need 10 etudes. So, you know, and I would just start to go, well, we're going to have one in this key and one in that key, and alternating thumb and not alternating thumb. And this one's going to be in open position, and, you know. And then when I started doing my own membership, I wanted to really focus on traditional blues tunes, which I hadn't spent that much time on. But every few months, there would be something I would want to illustrate where I couldn't think of a public domain tune off the top of my head that was going to be good for that. So I would go, well, I'll write something like it, you know, like all the John Hurt stuff is, for the best John Hurt stuff you'd want to do is copywritten. So I just came up with a tune that was like, well, this is inspired by John Hurt, but it goes here and it does this, and he wouldn't have done that, but that's what makes it interesting. So sometimes there's a guitar idea. Sometimes there's sort of like a little challenge, a little spark. Can I play to illustrate something? Would that help?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so on the new record, I got really into this piano player named James Booker from New Orleans. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he has a piece called Pixie, where he starts off playing this kind of climbing bass line, and he's playing like the bass line and he's hitting some chords, and then the melody comes in. It sounds like he has three hands, and I was like, that's really slick. So when I was coming up with stuff for a True Fire lesson, I was like, well, I want to have that kind of climbing thing in the bass, right? So I'm in drop D, probably not totally in tune. And then I'm going, coming up the low string, just going the root, second, flat, third, third. And then I was like, well, I'll alternate that with the open fourth string. I'm like, great. Now I'm using both my hands and everything's used up. All my resources used up and I've still only got the left hand going. So I was like, well, how do I make the melody go on top of that? And so, you know, here's all the bluesy notes out of a D chord shape. And so I was just like, well, how do I put a melody on top? So it just started as like a little game. Like, I wonder if this will work, you know? What I think it was like a what if, you know? Like, what if you got that bass line going and then you got the licks going on top? And so that's all that was for the True Fire lesson. And I was like, well, that's 16 seconds of music. Like, I can't perform that. And I knew all along, it's like, well, I got to be able to figure out how to improvise on that. And so when I sat down to work on the record, I was like, I had my friend Brett Boyer produced it, who's a fantastic musician and guitar player. And he was like, and I played a bunch of different things for him. And he was like, well, what about that one? I was like, well, that's all it is. And he was like, well, can you solo on it? And I was like, maybe, you know? So then I had to sit and work out how to do that. And then, you know, then gradually that became the tune. It's basically just like play the melody, take a little solo, do a little stop time, play the melody, and you're out. Sometimes it's more elaborate than that. I made a record back in 2006 or 2007, where there was really almost no improvising. Everything was like these multi-part structures, you know. There'd be like an A section, B section, there'd be like a bridge, really complicated. Most of them were just like pieces that I would just sit and play. But I like being able to improvise. So I've been trying to, you know, gradually work out more and more of that.
That sounded great, man. So I don't know if you know, he's also a True Fire guy, actually. A guitarist called Tony McManus. He plays Celtic fingerstyle guitar. So he was one of my teachers for a little while. He's an amazing guitar player. And one of the things that he really focuses on is kind of bringing out the melody of a guitar, bringing out the main melody notes that you're trying to play kind of dynamically. How much do you think about that when you're playing that kind of thing?
I think about it to the extent that I'm thinking foreground, background, and it's why I do so much palm muting. This is one of the first things that I think really separates blues from folk, which is if you learn pattern picking, you know, you leave the bass open. And so it sounds more like arpeggiation, like it's an accompaniment, right? And so everything is kind of given the same value. If you start to mute the bass, you're pushing it into the background. And that lets the notes on top and I think a lot about, not super consciously, I mean, all of these things I think about more because I teach them, right? And so when I'm playing, it's more intuitive, but there's this feedback loop where sometimes I'm trying to explain one thing and a student says, well, wait, but you're doing this other thing. What's that about? And then I have to go, oh, I don't know. Let me find out. You know, like I didn't know how much I do this thing that I now think of as like faking the fourth string, where if I'm playing an E and I want to improvise and I'm alternating the thumb. Well, if I start to go up the neck, I thought I was covering this note, but I'm really just damping it. And it's basically like, you know, it's fake. It's not really there, you know, but in context, I slowed it down.
Yeah, it becomes rhythmic, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I like having that backbeat in there. So now that I've been made aware of it, I'm kind of like, well, yeah, I'm okay with that because it serves this rhythmic function, and it gives you a little more latitude up the neck. But it's not something that I worked out on purpose. It's more something I just found out I was doing. But so back to the melody, yeah, like I'll think about like, I mean, I am, because I'm not playing pattern picking, I am thinking of it as licks over a bass. Mm. I am thinking about, on some level, whether I'm consciously thinking about it or not, I'm trying to shape the melody and I'm using what I have in my control, which is how hard I pick and whether I use vibrato and whether I'm sliding or hammering on or pulling off or all these things. You know, I want the phrase to sound cool. So my hands are doing what my ears tell me makes it sound cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting because, what you're saying about kind of approaching it like it's a bass line with a melody over it rather than it being a kind of picking pattern. I find that when I'm teaching, particularly fingerstyle stuff, that's kind of where people tend to really struggle when it comes to playing blues, is that they, you know, they can't figure out the picking pattern for this Mance Lipscomb tune. And it may well be that there isn't a specific picking pattern to learn. It's not, you know, thumb, third finger, second finger, you know, that doesn't have that specific pattern. And I find that that's where a lot of people struggle. Do you find the same in your teaching?
Oh, yeah. I feel like my whole job is to take people's playing apart so we can put it back together. Mm. Because most people who know how to finger pick learn to pattern pick first. So, I mean, that's how I learned. And, you know, I did this lesson on YouTube that was called something like six steps to fix your Travis picking in six steps. Because when I teach, I have this approach. A lot of my teaching is just sort of like trying to codify and give names for things that I did intuitively when I was trying to figure things out. And now I want to explain them. So I got to kind of put a handle on it so other people can pick it up and carry it back to their house. So when I'm teaching someone to learn a basic arrangement, I give them this thing to do that I call the horizontal three step, which is first, you want to think about the fact that music is unfolding horizontally in time, right? Like there's the horizontal and the vertical. So a chord is vertical, but an arpeggio is horizontal, right? Like a chord is all the notes at once, but I'm doing all this gesturing with my hands and nobody can see. But I mean, like, you know, a chord is vertical. You know, you picture it on the page, everything's stacked up, but an arpeggio, that's happening horizontally. So music's unfolding horizontally. So the bass is unfolding horizontally. So when you get this arrangement that's like, if you're doing, you're right, there is no pattern, right? The only thing that's really remotely repetitive is the bass. And so I'm like, we got to take this apart. The first step is to isolate the bass. The second step is to isolate the melody. Learn those as two discrete horizontal things that have their own logic, and then start putting them together vertically by using the bass as a reference point of like, well, I'm either pinching with the bass or my notes are going on in between. So if we look at those first couple of measures, the bass is doing this. And so I'd say, look, play through all eight bars. Make sure you can do everything the bass is doing. Then look at the melody. And make sure you're not doing what I just did, which is like I slid to these notes that I'm never going to be able to reach when I'm actually holding down the bass. Yeah. You got to pay attention to where you're going to be. And the thing about learning the melody alone is like it helps you hear the melody in terms of groupings, like phrases. That's because I'm sure you've noticed, like, people have a hard time remembering what to play next. But if they're thinking about the melody, it's like, oh, this is actually a phrase. It's not 3-0, 3-0-0. It's baby, please don't go.
Actually, that's a really great one for that, isn't it? Because we can all hear that in our heads. You know,
exactly. And so if you can hear that, then you go, okay, well, how are these two things going to happen at the same time? Because our whole job is to create the illusion of two things, of like, you know, of an ensemble, right? It's like it's a bass and a melody. So that's all happening before you even get to the bass. This is the first time that we get the bass together. And then the bass is carrying on doing its own thing. Oh, now we're going to have a couple of pinches in between the pinch, 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 pinch. Right. So now the bass is kind of like your foundation, and you're like building these little, like, you know, pillars up from the bass. And at the top of the pillar are the pinches. And then in between, you got, you know, the things, everything that isn't a pinch, basically. So it gives you this way to break it down where it's like, I know where the melody, I know where the bass is, I know the melody, and I know every melody note is either with a thumb or in between.
Mm.
And so it gives you a way to kind of work your way through the song. But I did this lesson on fixing your Travis picking, and I used Freight Train as an example. And this one comment said something like, well, you're not even really doing Travis picking. You're putting a independent bass, putting an independent improvised melody over the bass. And I was like, yeah, exactly. I just called it Travis picking because that's the easiest thing.
That's what we think of
to
it
call alternating thumb picking. But yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to communicate, is you need that independent thumb and you need that independent melody, and you need to know how to combine them if you want to play melodies and not arpeggiated patterns. So that's
And I think the way that you explained it there, the kind of thinking of it like, I guess, it's written out as music, is really useful. I think one of the stumbling blocks a lot of people have is that they want to learn a song, for example, Baby Please Don't Go, and they just go online and they find some tab, and then they immediately get met with like all of it at once. But if you were, if you were to take apart the bass part first, and you just started with a few bars of bass, and then you add in the main melody, and then you add in the embellishments after that, it would be considerably clearer. I think it's a bit of a overwhelming thing when you get a complex kind of finger picking tune just written out as music, you know?
Yeah, because I came up with this because I would see people trying to learn from tab, and they would go, well, in the first I have to play this, and then I have to grip this, and then I have to grab that. And they were moving they were up so close to what they were doing that they weren't coming from like a musical place about it. And I think it gets really frustrating because you want to feel like you want to be able to see that you're going to be able to play something musical. So I'm like, the thumb is telling you so much. It's telling you the groove. It's telling you the chord progression. It's, you know, it's telling you the feel. Like, it's the rhythm section. It's like everything but the melody. So if you can get that dialed in, you have this bigger picture. And now you're like, oh, now I'm going to play a melody over that. Okay, that'll be great.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like I was saying about Tony McManus, one of the things he would have me do is with the Celtic tunes especially, is to really learn the melody, like play the melody on its own for a long time. So it's like, it's in my head exactly how it's supposed to sound. So I can't kind of fool myself into, you know, falling into an easier picking pattern because it sounds kind of like how it sounds. You know, you got to try and really get to grips with what the melody you're going for is.
And my impression, I do not know much about Celtic music at all, but my impression is the accompaniment is a little more fluid. It's not so much patterns and things.
Yeah,
so
it's more kind of...
How did that work? Once you learn the melody, what was the next step?
So it's basically harmonizing and arpeggiating a lot of the time. It's a lot of this tunes are either taken from bagpipe songs, if they're kind of from Scotland, or harp songs. And it's you end up, you know, these kind of flourishing arpeggios underneath the melody. But if you look at it on a page, especially if you don't know the melody incredibly well, if you look at it on a page, it's like, what is happening there? Like, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. And it's so true of blues and, you know, country style finger picking as well. It's really the same kind of thing. It's all about making that melody sing.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I always have to do this, like, disclaimer. You know, when you go back and listen to the pre-war blues guitar players, they are not playing the bass often nearly as systematically as someone modern like I would. Like, that steady bass thing, not really, you know. Like, I mean, I'm sure there's someone who can like cite me chapter and verse of when it is like that. But I mean, Vance Lipscomb, maybe more him, but like Lightnin' Hopkins, it's real, like it's a real dance between the melody and the bass. Never mind about Lightnin' Hopkins famously not playing the same, you know, progression, like the same number of bars every time. But I think that's also a 1960s development. I think it comes from people learning that stuff off of records and needing to make some sort of system for themselves, or, you know, needing to turn around and show that to a friend or like to a new guitar student, you know. So I think that that's sort of a thing that's developed, you know, and which is fine. I think the music sort of develops, and also like fingerstyle guitar is my technique, but in terms of what I am listening to and I mean, there's a lot of music that I like that I'm trying to sort of funnel through that technique, and it's not just pre-war blues. So, you know, if I'm listening to like, you know, a Lee Morgan record with a, you know, really consistent kind of pulse and groove, then yeah, I'm going to want to try to make my thumb do this very consistent regular thing, you know, to kind of reflect what it is I'm trying to do.
One of the other guys that you're playing sometimes reminds me of is Jorma. And I know that you opened for him, right?
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at rootsmusicrambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
I did, yeah. There was a place on the campus of the University of Texas called the Cactus Cafe that was like the place for, you know, it wasn't that big. And for bigger shows, they had another place they would do stuff. But, you know, like Lyle Lovett and Nancy Griffith had both played there a million times, you know, being in Texas in the 80s and 90s or whenever it was. So Jorma was in town. He was touring the country record he made, Blue Country Heart, I think. And I knew the people playing with him because it was Cindy Cash Dollar on dobro, who I knew sort of from the dobro world. And then this mandolin player, Barry Mitterhoff, who I didn't really know, but I had known a bunch of the sort of New York bluegrass guys who were a generation ahead of me in New York when I lived there. People like Tony Trischka and Stacy Phillips, I had like sort of crossed paths with. So they were playing. And so I went to see the show. And he was there for two nights and it was packed. And during the intermission for the first night, I heard Griff Lundberg, the owner of the manager of the place, like paging me or calling out for me or something. And he was like, "Hey, do you want to open tomorrow night? Because they should have had an opening act tonight." I was like, "Yeah, that'd be amazing."
That's awesome.
So I did, but of course, I mean, and I know enough about this to like not to take it personally, but like, you know. Of course, I was hoping like that Jorma would hear me play, right? Because he's a hero of mine. But like the opening act is when the touring act has time to finally go eat dinner.
Yeah.
Know? So like I finished playing and like then I saw Cindy coming in. She was like, "Oh, we wanted to hear you, but like it was our only chance." And I was like, "Yeah, I get it. Don't worry about it." but yeah, so that was really fun. And it was great to, I'd only seen him live like once before. And I loved seeing him in that little trio context. Yeah, I mean, he was one of the guys that you could learn that kind of music from if you didn't have the other records. I mean, I got to college and the guy next door to me had like a million records and he had that first Tatuna record. And
the live one?
The live one. It's just the two of them and it's got like the sort of like abstract purple and red photograph on the cover. And they play all the Gary Davis stuff, you know, like he does. Yeah. I mean, plus, I mean, that's what, I mean, I sat down and like, you know, I mean, I didn't learn it note for note, like that was, which was kind of great in a way that there wasn't any tab. It was just like, I learned how to play what I thought he was doing behind the vocals. And that was like, okay, now I've learned that song. And it was kind of liberating. I feel bad when I see a student come in with like a 10-page transcription And they think they're supposed to learn this whole thing. I'm like, Yorma couldn't play it note for note the way he played it that night. Just get the idea, get the groove, get the voicings, maybe figure out like kind of where he's improvising on the neck. And then like, you know, just do it. But I learned, you know, Hesitation Blues and Know You Rider and Death Don't Have No Mercy and maybe one or two others off that record, whatever I could figure out.
Yeah, me too, man. Me too. I think that record was one of the kind of like a gateway for me getting into a lot of the older music. As you say, like that way of learning is a much more traditional way of learning, you know, listening to somebody play and then emulating, you know, your version of what they played, you know. And
this is a real
back. How it develops.
Yeah. I mean, I have this conversation with myself all the time, which is, and with like, you know, with my students or audience or whatever you want to call it, because I mean, I write in my weekly newsletter, I kind of just write about whatever I'm thinking about music that week. And a lot of what I'm thinking about are these kinds of things like, you know, how much did I actually learn stuff note for note? And how important is it for a student to learn stuff note for note? Because I will say these things like I just said, like, you know, just get close. And then people will respond like, no, it's really satisfying and important to me. I want to know exactly what they're doing before I start to change it. And I'm like, actually, I get it. Because with the stuff that matters most to me at this point, you know, like I've transcribed a lot of hard bop from the 50s and 60s, you know, I love, you know, Stanley Turrentine and Lee Morgan and Tommy Flanagan and all these musicians who play like in a very blues based, they've got a lot of blues sensibility, but they're real beboppers. And so they have that back and forth. I almost said dialectic and realized how pretentious that would sound. They've got that thing between blues and bebop that I really love. And there's people that are so far to the abstract end of it that it's not bluesy anymore. And there's people that are so bluesy, they're not playing the changes. And I love that place right in the middle. So when I'm going to learn like how Stanley Turrentine gets from 1 to 4, I want to learn it exactly. Like I'll get the amazing slow downer out and I'll go through it with a fine tooth comb and I'll EQ out the bass. And I'm like, I want to know exactly what notes he's playing, but I'm also not a saxophone player. So I'm like, well, he slurred that or he didn't slur this. Mm-hmm. And we kind of like, you know, honked that note. Well, I can't do that, but I do want to get the pitches because I'm dying to know like, what the hell is going on? Like, how do they make those lines sound like that? But once I've learned them, written them down, like I'd like to memorize them and assimilate them. But what usually happens is I go, oh, that's how they do it. And I get the general idea of like, oh, they tend to chromaticize this. They don't chromaticize that. They use a chord substitution like this here. They don't there. Now I have kind of a roadmap and I know kind of what they're doing. And I'm kind of like, there aren't enough hours in the day to go back and memorize all the things that I transcribed. So I understand where these students are coming from. And my version of that is just, well, if I'm going to teach Baby Please Don't Go, I'll listen to 8 or 10 different versions so that I know that I'm playing the melody the way I know that I'm getting like an average of how the melody is supposed to go. And then I'll go, well, some people play this over one chord, but that version I just played where you go to the 4 chord, that's Big Bill Brunzi. And it's a point of pride that I know that because I'm like, oh, I like what Big Bill Brunzi does. He goes to the 4 chord. That makes it a little more colorful to me than just staying on the 1. But it's important also to know that the melody, when people don't go to the 4 chord, they play the melody a little differently. So Big Bill, his melody is, you know, when he gets to the 4 chord. But if you're staying on the 1, people will just go there for the second phrase. They'll go. And the rest will be the same. But so I take pride in doing my homework. But then I'm like, okay, I've done my homework. Now this is what we're going to do. The one thing that the thing that I say to my students is, and to myself is like, we're not going to learn so-and-so's version of the song. We're going to learn a version of the song. We're going to learn the song, not the version of the song. So yes, there is a note for note way to play the Big Bill Brunzi version. We're not doing that. We're learning the melody. We're learning the chords. We're learning the groove. We're learning how to put that together. Then we're going to do something with it. And I finally felt completely 100% okay about that when I saw Tom Bresch at the Chet Atkins Appreciation Society conference a few years ago. And Tom Bresch, you know, he's Merle Travis's son and he plays all that stuff. And I thought he was going to get up and just play like Merle Travis note for note. And he got up and the first thing he did was just like play this funny song that he had written. And then he played a few instrumentals, and then he did a Merle thing. And at one point he literally said, I don't ever play anything note for note. I figure I got my thumb. And he held up his thumb with the thumb because I got my thumb. I got the melody and I got my imagination. And I was like, this is my guy.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Travis's son. So if he can do it, I can do it. Everybody can do it. You know? I was like, I just felt like this big wave of permission wash over me.
Yeah.
And he was my favorite guy there. You know, like his guitar just sounded like an acoustic guitar. He had a funky, funky groove. He was a great singer and he was really entertaining. He was just like such a musician. And, you know, there were a lot of great people there, and there were people all the way from people who were like, I have the same guitar as Chet, and I'm going to get up and play with the same delay as Chet, and it's going to sound just like his arrangement of Mr. Sandman, all the way to like super modern people who were like, you know, I got an octave doubler on the bass, and I got like, it sounds like God in here. It's like, it looks like an acoustic guitar, but it sounds like the Edge.
Yeah.
It was all great. But like after a whole day and night of that, Tom Bresch came out and he just like picked the guitar and sang some songs and rocked the place. And I was just like, this is just so relaxing because it's such a groove. You can just fall into this pocket and chill. And not that it was mellow or laid back. It was just like his groove was so profound that it was just like pure joy to listen to the guy.
Yeah, it's really cool. You were saying about transcribing bebop stuff. That's really interesting. You've obviously written a lot of instructional books on kind of different styles of guitar playing and different styles of music. How important do you think it is to learn different styles of music?
I'm of two minds about this, right? I mean, I think, you know, everything that you suck into your orbit becomes part of what you do. And if you can figure out how to, if you can figure out how to recombine that yourself, or if you can just allow it to happen, then that's wonderful. I don't think there's any point in learning something because you should. I mean, people are always like, should I learn this? Should I learn? I'm like, I don't know. Do you care about it? When people used to call up for private lessons a million years ago, the first thing I always said was, well, what do you want to be able to do? You know, and they're like, well, I want to be able to play like so-and-so. I'm like, great. Do you listen to their records? Do you figure out their stuff? You know, like I transcribed all that bebop stuff because I always loved listening to jazz, and I was always frustrated that I had never really learned how to play that kind of music the way I wanted to. And when I finally crystallized exactly what it was about it, I was like, you know what? I don't want to be able to play every kind of jazz. I don't want to be able to play every kind of tune. I literally just want to know how those guys that I like from the 50s and 60s played changes on the blues progression. That is literally the beginning and end of what I want to know. Maybe something else will come out of that, but I just want to know when Kenny Burrell or Grant Green or Hank Mobley plays on the blues form, why does it sound different from Charlie Christian? And why does Charlie Christian sound different from B.B. King? Like, what is the difference here? You know? And so the only way to really find out is what like academics call close reading. Like you just go in and when you're like in college or high school and you're trying to write a paper, like the first thing you do is you just kind of like write a bunch of crap and you just like, you know, you kind of skate over it. And then if you get a good teacher, they go, you know, where are the quotes? Where did you actually get this from? Can you source your point? And then you get to the point where you're like, at least I did, because I was lucky to have some really good teachers. Like the way I wrote a paper was I just looked for all the quotes first and made sure that I like had the evidence for what I wanted to talk about. And then I would write the paper and just be like, well, now I got, here's this supporting piece and here's this supporting piece. So if I'm going to learn how bebop guys play blues, like go look at it. Like, what are they doing? And it's like, well, every time they go from the one to the four chord, they seem to have these kinds of things seem to be happening. This guy does it and that guy does it. And this person over here does it. Oh, these are the moves. Oh, what are they doing when they get to the sixth chord? Oh, that's where they play the altered stuff. So rather than going, oh, I should learn the super Locrian scale because I hear it's important for altered scales. Altered sounds. It's like, no, I just listened to what they were doing and realized, I mean, like it helped that I knew what an altered sound was when I got there. But so there's this dance between like getting the information, like what are the scales? What do they mean? Where are they derived from? And then looking at, you need to have like, it helps to have that understanding so that when you encounter it, you can hear it for what it is. So like playing blues in F, right? So I'm going from F to D, mm-hmm. and then over to G minor, which is an important thing to be able to do. It helps to know, first of all, why we're playing D, which is the D7 is there to get you to G minor. It's a chord substitution the bebop guys added into the swing progression. So it's nice to know that all the bebop guys grew up playing swing and then started to monkey with it. And then to know that there is a moment where there's an overlap where the F chord shares some of the same notes with the D chord,
yeah.
and that there's one place where the rubber meets the road where suddenly you know you've made that move. But what makes it so beautiful is it's this dovetailed thing where until you hit that note, it's not clear that you've made the transition yet. So when you hear that, once you know that it's going from this to this, which is only a one note difference, well, obviously, if you just sat and played that, it would sound kind of dumb. But if you know what the landing points are, and that's just quarter notes, but they're, you know, now we've got, now you can start to phrase it. And you don't have to play it like a machine gun, like.
But when you do, it's like you're playing Django.
Well, yeah, but you want it to, like, I mean, the thing that makes it swing is that, like, maybe you don't play every note, and maybe, like, you make sure that the phrasing's in your head, the rhythm, the swing rhythm's in your head, but you duck and weave, and, like, you're connecting up. You know where the whole steps are that you can play chromatically, and you're not playing chromatically for chromatic sake. You're playing chromatically to land hard on the note you want, so that you end up with. Off to the races. But I don't remember whose lick that is, but I know that I heard like four or five people do it, and I went, oh, that's what they're doing.
That's so interesting, man. It's so cool. And it has a real gypsy jazz sound about it, doesn't it?
Well, yeah,
when you take that and put it on an acoustic.
I mean, now I have to say there's a huge gulf between knowing that sitting in my room and being able to go out and play jazz for 3 hours with people, and that gulf exists. So I'm not like, and I'm crushing the bebop front. It's just that's an interest of mine, and so like I like knowing how that works, and it feeds into what I do when I'm playing, because that's, you know, if I'm finger picking and I'm playing a chord progression, well, now I need to know there's a direct application of the fact that, well, okay, this is basically functioning as an altered chord, this A flat. So it wants a flat nine on top, not a natural nine on top. And it's going to resolve down to this C minor, which I can take chromatically to this. I'm really on my way to an A chord, right? I'm just making it a tricky move to an A chord. I'm really just doing this. I'm just.
Yeah, that's the BC though, isn't it?
So understanding that kind of harmonic motion means you can do more interesting things with a 12-bar blues or an 8-bar blues, just because you have some familiarity with the way chords resolve as well as the way that things resolve.
How much theory did you learn when you were learning guitar? Like when you first started?
Obviously. I found theory really mysterious. I mean, I remember my guitar teacher writing out all kinds of stuff for me in high school, and it didn't make any sense to me at all. I always tell people I learned theory four different times before it sank in. I had it from my teacher. I took it. I had a jazz improvisation class in junior high. I had a class in high school. I had a summer class. And then I finally took it. I took like a jazz improvisation class in college. And it was like that fourth time when, you know, we were sitting around studying and someone said, well, like, I still don't understand the Dorian mode. And I was like, oh, it's just blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh my God, I understand it. You know, but it took a lot of tries. you know?
Yeah, I totally get that. I actually found I learned more through teaching than I did through anything absolutely. Else, you know?
I mean, for sure. I mean, then I got this job in the summers where I taught week-long classes for 6 weeks. And so I was teaching guitar players how to play blues, but we were supposed to cover all the basic theory behind some pentatonic scales. So I was teaching that stuff 2 or 3 times a day for 6 weeks.
Wow.
And so after a couple of summers of that, like,
that'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to think about it. You're just like, it is what it is. And then you have to think about, you have to remember that it's not obvious to everybody and that you got to walk them through it.
Absolutely. Oh, David, thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting. It's so great to hear from you. I will make sure to point everybody in the direction of all of the stuff you're doing, the new recordings you're doing. Any idea when they're going to be out?
I hesitate to say, because the last record took me 4 years to actually release into the world. I'm going to try to do it in more like 4 months this time. But, hopefully later this spring or this summer, once I figure out if I'm going to do physical copies again or just, do a digital release, which would obviously be a lot faster. It was fine. It was fun recording it, but now I've got to, figure out how to mix and master it and all that stuff. So
do you do all that yourself?
Nah, this is the first time I recorded in my own space. I've always gone elsewhere. But I've been recording in here for 15 years doing like other things, just never like an art project, like a record of my own. Mm. So I got some help and I got some new microphones and upgraded my interface and was like, let's try it. And it sounds pretty good. So that's kind of exciting.
I'm just going to throw in one extra question at you. how many different kind of guitars do you normally use if you're going to record something like an album?
Just
the Martin?
Yeah, because it's a solo record and I'm like, this is the guitar. And then, because otherwise, it's kind of lazy, but it's like, otherwise it's like, well, then when I'm mixing, I'm gonna have to take different guitars into account. And what if I get to the end and I realize one guitar sounded better and I wish I'd use it on this song when I didn't? And we tried 3 guitars. So I have this guitar and I have a Collings that's my main performing guitar. I have a Collings 002H. And that's the one I've used on all the True Fire stuff because it's my quote unquote travel guitar, which I realize is a pretty uptown thing to have a Collings for a travel guitar. But I did it, my last record, Beautiful Scar, I did in Knoxville, Tennessee. So I brought it there. I don't really travel with the Martin. So I brought the Collings and I did it on the Collings. Mm. And a really good friend of mine has a very similar guitar, a Santa Cruz 00 something that's mahogany. And we tried that too, just when we set up. And the Martin just sounded the best. It just had this killer high end where all the melody notes were just like bulletproof, like nothing snappy or thin or anything. Not that the others didn't sound good, but the Martin just sounded fantastic. And I thought, I'm here in my own studio. What the heck? I'm going to use that. So
yeah, great.
I mean, I've got all these other things hanging on the wall, resonator guitars and different things, but the Martin just, I've had that guitar for so long. I just love playing it. So it was good to make a document of something with that.
Cool, man. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to hear it. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope they'll catch up with you soon. Are you fully fretboard confident? Do you know where the notes are, how they connect, and how they move up and down the strings? My latest book, The Triad Method, is all about using simple 3-note shapes to completely unlock the fretboard. This book is absolutely full of light bulb moments that are going to demystify the neck 3 notes at a time. I've compiled a huge number of diagrams, shapes, and exercises based on over 10 years of teaching this stuff to make it as simple as possible. Download The Triad Method and see for yourself today. Link is in the description below.